From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
To drill or not to drill? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. From President Bush on down, Republicans are advocating an end to the moratorium on offshore oil drilling. High gasoline prices are increasing public support, even though there would be no direct impact for decades. On To the Point, we'll hear from members of Congress on both sides of what's shaping up as a major election year issue. Would the declared intention to expand domestic supplies send the right message to oil producers and speculators around the world? Should oil companies drill first on land they've already leased? What about seizing the moment to get off oil and deal with global warming? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Barack Obama visits Iraq. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. John McCain and other Republicans say it's time to start drilling for oil off the shores of America. Barack Obama leads those Democrats who say not so fast. On To the Point, how soon would gasoline prices be affected? Would just the intent to drill send the right message to the rest of the world? What about dealing with climate change? On Reporter's Notebook, Senator Obama, Iraq's Prime Minister Maliki, and a timetable for troop withdrawal. First, this news update. America's first war crimes trial since World War II got underway today in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The defendant, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, will provide a test case for military tribunals criticized by opponents as legal shams designed to secure convictions. Jerry Marcon is covering the proceedings for The Washington Post. And, Jerry, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Who is Mr. Hamdan, and what is he accused of?
Well, Mr. Hamdan, it really depends on who you talk to. I think both sides agree that he was a driver for Osama bin Laden. His defense lawyers acknowledge that. His defense says that he was merely a chauffeur, basically, a paid employee who drove Mr. bin Laden from place to place, whereas the prosecution says that he was actually, you know, a member of al-Qaeda and a terrorist, basically, who he's charged with materially supporting terrorism. They say that he ferried weapons for al-Qaeda and that he escaped, you know, helped Mr. bin Laden escape before and after the 9/11 attacks.
What's the difference between this military tribunal and a civilian court?
Yeah, very good question. The main difference is probably the admissibility of certain evidence. Unlike in a civilian court, evidence gained from what is considered coercive interrogation methods, one might call them harsh interrogation methods, can be admissible in certain circumstances if the judge deems it relevant and reliable. And I should add that if those statements were obtained before 2005, this coercive treatment can even be deemed to have been cruel and inhuman. That's a quote from a law. Congress in 2005 changed that and said that, you know, future trials after statements obtained after 2005, the treatment can't be cruel and inhuman, but it could still be coercive. So anyway, you can see in any event that's a significant difference. And hearsay evidence is also admissible in certain circumstances. And possibly the biggest difference of all in Mr. Hamdan's case and in the case of the others down here is that even if he's acquitted, he's not going to be released because he's still an enemy combatant, which is a separate designation by the military. And we can talk more about that issue, but that's obviously a big difference. If you're acquitted in court in the U.S., you usually walk free, and he won't.
Who are the judge and jury?
Well, one word, military, it being a military commission. The judge is a U.S. Navy captain named Keith Allred, and he wears a black robe like any other judge and wrestles with legal issues and you know, does seem to be, certainly based on what he says, trying to keep the proceedings as fair as possible. The jurors, quote-unquote jurors, who are actually military officers, came in today, and he kept emphasizing to them the need to keep an open mind and, you know, and be fair and impartial. The quote-unquote jury is the commission, essentially. It's a group of military officers from all different branches. They have not been narrowed down yet to the final number, but 13 possible jurors were in court being questioned by both sides this morning, and the best way to say it is they're all officers, mostly from the Army and Navy. I think there was one Marine and one or two Air Force.
So this is obviously not a jury of Mr. Hamdan's peers. He's a fairly low-level guy, even according to the charges that have been made against him. In what way is this a test case for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others that are going to be tried as well?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the prosecutors will probably question the description of him as a low-level guy. He does appear to be, based on what's been released so far. I think we should hear all the evidence before we conclude that.
Okay.
But, it is absolutely a dry run. Because, whatever Mr. Hamdan's, low guy or high guy status or whatever, he's certainly nowhere near as high as some of the people who are going to follow him in the dock here at Guantanamo, and those include some of the self-confessed, masterminds of 9/11, the people who planned the attacks. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example, has publicly said that he is the mastermind of the attacks, and he is also charged, and Ramzi bin al-Shib, another key 9/11 planner, and several others have been charged and are coming here as well. So, they haven't really said why Mr. Hamdan is first, but, one possible reason could be that it is a way to sort of test the system, so to speak.
The Supreme Court struck down one military commission system. The Congress came back with the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Is this something that's likely to be reviewed again by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, almost certainly. I mean, all these issues are going to be litigated, to the highest levels of the U.S. Judicial system, from Hamdan's, if there's a conviction in Hamdan's case, it would certainly be reviewed, which is a protection, by the way, that he did not have under the original system. Judicial review was added in the last couple of years after the Supreme Court struck down the original system, as you said. And, the Supreme Court is reviewing these things regularly. I'm certain the Military Commissions Act will be challenged. I'm sure there's lawsuits that have been filed. I don't think it's reached the Supreme Court level quite yet.
All right. Well, Jerry Marcon with The Washington Post covering the Hamdan trial in Guantanamo Bay. Many thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, to drill or not to drill on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point. The price of oil crossed the $100 a barrel threshold at the first of this year. 10 days ago, it hit a record of $147. Then last week, it dropped below $130. But it's creeping up again today on news of bad weather in the Gulf of Mexico and new U.S. threats of punitive measures against Iran over nuclear development. In short, there are unpredictable fluctuations, but nobody expects to see $100 a barrel ever again. That means high gasoline prices are here to stay, and recent polls show that, in turn, means more public support for oil drilling off American shores. Mike Conaway is a Republican congressman from the 11th District of Texas. Mr. Conaway, good to have you on our program.
Well, it's good to be with Stephanie.
You are favoring more exploration, more drilling, even though the Energy Department, Energy Information Administration, says there wouldn't be any impact on prices till 2030. How come?
Well, I don't think 2030 is the right answer. It will be a number of years before that will happen, but we could have said the same thing, 4 or 5 years ago, and today would be enjoying that crude oil. This is not a silver bullet. Republicans are saying all of the above, yes to conservation, yes to alternatives, but we have to try to work with and manage and retard the rate of growth in the cost of gasoline, the price of crude oil, which is the main feedstock for it. And by contributing American sources to the worldwide supply of crude oil, you will slow down the growth in the price of crude oil. Crude oil will always get more expensive. It's a finite resource, and we have to work between today and where we want to get to, and that means as much supply for today as we can get. So while it's not a magic bullet, we didn't get here overnight, it is something that we ought to be pursuing, along with nuclear, coal to liquids, clean-burning coal, alternatives, wind and solar. This is a broad array of solutions out there that each of us could figure out something that we like and grab a hold of that piece and push it forward, as opposed to saying, well, no to to the known crude oil that we do know, that we do need and use every single day, seems to be wrongheaded to me.
Mike Conaway, Republican congressman from Texas. Earl Blumenauer is a Democratic congressman. He's from Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. And Mr. Blumenauer, welcome to you.
It's good to be with you again, Warren.
How do you respond to what we has just heard, particularly when prices are going up and polls show that people are more and more, even in California, in favor of oil drilling off the shore?
Well, you had it right. It was the Energy Administration points out that we're not going to see any benefits from this for 20 years or more. The average American will be spending over $50,000 on gasoline before they get even a penny or two's difference. And no one's saying not to drill. I mean, we have 68 million acres of leased land that's available now. And I'm pleased that some of my Republican colleagues are now saying, yes, more inclusive, no silver bullet. They want to engage in conservation when, in fact, the Republican-controlled Congress has actually not been aggressively moving on that. They stopped us from even studying improving fuel efficiency standards for automobiles when they were in charge. And they've been dragging their feet and others. And most important, they're silent on one of the things that would make a difference immediately, and that's dealing with the speculative bubble. Whether, you know, oil prices have basically doubled in the last year. World demand has gone up maybe 2%. Our experts that have been testifying before us are conflicted about whether it's $10 a barrel or $50 a barrel, but there are few that feel that it isn't a significant part of this. We can squeeze the speculators. One of the things that we think we should do tomorrow is start releasing a little bit of oil from our strategic petroleum reserve. We've done this 3 times in the past in less than 20 years, and each time it has produced a significant reduction in the price of oil, and we think that might help bring things back into balance. We need to be looking comprehensively at a variety of these things. I agree with Mike about that, but we need to squeeze the speculators. We need to be not having the drillusion that the United States, with less than 2% of the proven oil supply, can continue to consume 25% of the world's petroleum. It just isn't going to be viable.
But you didn't focus on offshore oil drilling. Mr. Conaway points out that if we were to increase the world supply of oil, it would at least slow the increase in prices. Why not drill offshore?
Well, we have millions of acres of leased land that is available now. Bear in mind that all of a sudden, when this conversation started coming up, the oil companies themselves said they don't have the equipment, they don't have the crews, they can't rapidly be able to do this now, and they're not using what they have. ExxonMobil last year spent more money buying back its stock than it did on exploration. We have to encourage the oil companies to use what they've got. That's why we had legislation that got overwhelming support, not quite 2/3, for using these leases or losing them last week in Congress.
Let me go back to Mike Conaway, a Republican from Texas. So what do you say to that? If the oil companies don't have the equipment, can't do the job, why shouldn't they focus on the leases they already have?
Well, quite frankly, they are. That's a red herring that my good friends have bantied around. They can't show us where the $68 million acre number. You know, how much of that $68 million was leased within the last 2 years, which no one would argue that could be in production? How much of it is tied up in the regulatory morass that Chairman Rahal, Mr. Blumenauer's chairman of the Resources Committee, brags about having in place? How much of that acreage is kept from being explored because of that? How much of the acreage is held up in court, how much of the acreage is actually being drilled right now, and how much of that acreage is ready for production but is waiting those final regulatory concerns and the movement, you know, the pipelines and other ways of moving that product from where it's drilled to the market. So to simply throw out a number, is it's a red herring, and it seems to work for them because they continue to preach it. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is in place for the odd eventuality that we couldn't get the oil from anywhere else. You know, it's 84 million barrels a day, 85 million barrels a day produced, 70,000 barrels a day, 50,000 barrels a day, whatever this tiny amount that we're talking about. is quite a small percentage, and folks who glom onto that, I think, are reasonably bad at math.
But it is full, is it not?
And, no, it's not.
It's not full, isn't it? 97% or some way up there?
Well, it's close, but it's not full, and we've suspended, which I agree with, we've suspended purchases and production into that, leaving that oil in the market itself. So that reserve is it's a savings account, and we're not at a position where we can't buy the oil that we need. And then the other idea about leasing, there should be a constant flow and a constant pipeline of leases available. When you're hung up in regulatory burdens, you're hung up in court, which happens every time somebody gets a federal lease, they're almost automatically sued. That idles the geologists, geophysicists, and engineers while they wait for that to work its way through the system. So they need other leases to be able to be working on. The 2% proved reserves is you only prove reserves when you actually drill. So we're working off of ancient data. Off the East Coast, when we try to guess at how much oil we think is there, a simple thing would be to agree to let us shoot seismic in Anwar. That is non-intrusive; it doesn't hurt anything. Could be done. If it proves that the oil is not there, then the environmentalists can say, "Well, never mind." But if it does prove that the oil is there, then it would help, with the supply issue. And then one final thing about the SPR and the other initiatives, particularly the one that passed in early June, in which we're going to sue or let Americans. Americans sue OPEC for additional supplies, it's clearly a statement that supply is a part of what's going on here. When you've got a wafer-thin difference between supply and demand, which is what we have, then news like a potential hurricane in the Gulf, rebel attacks in the Niger Delta, all of this unsettledness about the supply, then works in favor of the speculators that Mr. Blumenauer thinks are the bigger cause.
Mike Conaway, Republican of Texas. Back to Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon. You haven't mentioned the environment. Conaway was the first one to mention it. Isn't that what this is about, the argument about offshore oil drilling?
Certainly. People, for example, in California, a Republican governor there who opposes it, and the Republican governors, including the president's own brother, Jeb Bush in Florida, opposed it. That is a concern. But it's more fundamental, and my friend talks about red herrings. Well, what he is talking about are more fundamental red herrings. The regulatory morass that Mike refers to, the Republicans have been in control for the last 7 years in the administration. This is they have been in control when they wrote their energy bill of 2005, which was supposed to be regulatory streamlining. They can't continue to beat this dead horse when they're in control of it. And the point about razor-thin margins and tight supply, that's exactly why the Strategic Petroleum Reserve can tamp down the speculators. It has been used three times, not only because we couldn't get oil anyplace else. The first President Bush did it in 1991. Oil prices dropped one-third, and we were able to get oil from other sources then. It was a signal. And it's, I think, ironic that the Republicans aren't willing to allow a signal to the market. Worldwide demand has only gone up 2% in the last year. Oil prices has doubled. If you don't think there's a speculative bubble involved here, I think you need to check again.
Mr. Conaway, would offshore oil drilling or the intent to drill offshore, explore offshore, be a signal of another kind to the world market?
Well, it certainly would. It would say America is going to contribute her resources to this problem. Back in May of 2007, Mr. Blumenauer and his guys passed a appropriations bill which had an amendment on it that basically took oil shale off the table. Estimates from 1 to 2 trillion barrel equivalents of oil. Look what the price has done once the market was told that that oil shale will not be available to the market, and prices have climbed dramatically since May of 2007. That was a signal.
What about the
concerted signal that says we're going to drill offshore in a responsible, environmentally sensitive way. We're going to drill in Anwar. We're going to produce American resources, if for no other reason than to help us not have to buy oil from folks who hate our guts and turn around and use that money for bad things.
What about the one-third drop in prices when the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was, in fact, tapped in 1991?
Well, I'll have to go with Mr. Blumenauer's assessment. That's a fact I don't know.
Okay. Mr. Blumenauer, back again to the environment. Do you disagree that the technology has been perfected to the point where if there were drilling offshore, there wouldn't be environmental damage?
I think there have been significant advances in drilling technology. And we have millions of acres that are available now. And at some point, I'm not adverse to exploring with the states that are affected, because this is not something that is where the consequences are going to be visited on people in Kansas. It makes a difference for coastal states. In my state of Oregon, people would want to be very careful and serious about it. But I go back to what we started with. That will make no difference for more than 20 years. We need to do this is all being driven by anxiety at the pump now, which is understandable. We need to do things that will make a difference now.
Okay.
Conservation will make a difference now. Using the sources they have now will make a difference. Using the strategic oil reserve and squeezing the speculators will make a difference. Those are things that will make a difference to Americans this year, not in 2030.
Thank you both. We have exhausted the time we promised we would use. You're good to be with us. Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon. Mike Conaway, Republican of Texas. Thank you both.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Ben Geeman covers energy issues for the Greenwire News Service and Environment and Energy Daily. He tracks energy and environmental policy news. And Ben Geeman, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Obviously, we could go on for the rest of the hour with these two congresspeople making different points. What are the chances at this point that Congress will, in fact, lift the moratorium on offshore oil drilling?
Well, I think in the debate we were just hearing between the two members of Congress, you can see that there is a fairly sharp partisan battle going on here in Washington, D.C. over these issues. On the other hand, you know, there's some push to do something when lawmakers on both sides of the issue are certainly hearing from constituents who are paying, you know, well over $4 a gallon at the gasoline pump. You know, so that gets to the question, as you ask, whether or not they're supporting Congress for lifting the offshore moratorium. And right now, I do not see support for any type of broad-based, simply scrapping of the limits that exist right now. And those cover basically the East Coast, the West Coast, and a lot of the eastern Gulf of Mexico. Now, from there, whether there's going to be any type of energy deal in Congress this year, I think that's what everybody is right now trying to figure out. I mean, we're going to start to see this unfold a little bit in the very near future. In the Senate tomorrow, there's going to be a test vote, sort of a procedural vote on whether or not to formally debate a bill that would address oil speculation and try and expand regulation by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And to bring that back around to offshore drilling, what we're going to see is Republicans trying to amend that bill with measures on the offshore. Now, Democrats are under a lot of pressure here. As I think you may have pointed out earlier, we're seeing some growing support for offshore production. But right now, it looks fairly bottled up. The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California, has essentially categorically ruled out any changes or relaxation of the offshore drilling bans, calling it a hoax, the idea that offshore drilling, you know, wider offshore drilling is needed. The Senate Democratic leadership has also indicated that they don't believe this is the way to go, but they haven't categorically shut the door on it the way that the House Speaker Pelosi has.
Okay. All right. Hold that thought. We're going to take a very brief break, then we'll come back and continue this conversation with Ben Geeman and others on Reporter's Notebook a bit later. The Obama foreign tour in Iraq amid controversy over a timetable for troop withdrawal. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. High gasoline prices making the possibility of drilling for oil offshore and in other parts of the country that are now off limits a real political issue in this campaign, as this year, I should say. Robert Dillon covers Alaskan issues for the Energy Intelligence Group. He's also a columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. He's in Washington, but he's a native of Alaska. And Robert Dillon, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks a lot.
John Boehner, the Republican leader, has a group now in Alaska taking a look at, among other things, the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, currently off limits to drilling. What do you hear from Boehner's tour, and what are they doing? What's he advocating?
Well, I mean, he's trying to draw attention to the need to drill, and it's a nice PR move to take a bunch of freshman Republicans up there and show them what ANWR looks like, and stand up there and ask for oil drilling. you know, it's not likely to get a lot of Democrats votes, but it does keep the pressure on Democrats.
What the president is advocating, and many of the Republicans are advocating, is to give each state the option to drill offshore. If there were an option to drill in that part of Alaska, would it pass in that state? Would people be in favor of it?
Oh yeah, I mean, Alaska is a pro development state, and there's a majority of people that have long supported opening ANWR. It's been our congressional delegation's position for as many years as I can remember. So definitely, I think the state would be happy to open ANWR. In fact, Senator Murkowski was telling me on Friday that there's a House Republican who's offered a bill that would give ANWR back to the state, and because it's federal land right now, and I think most Alaskans would be happy to make that decision.
A moment ago, Ben Geeman made the point or raised the issue of whether or not some kind of deal would be worked out this year before the election, whether or not it's scrapping the moratorium on offshore oil drilling or not. What do you think? Do you think that that's possible, or are the Republicans getting too much political hay to want to reach an agreement?
Well, I think you're seeing some movement in some of the centrist Republicans and Democrats towards the middle, starting to work on some kind of compromise. But unfortunately, as you heard with your two guests earlier, I mean, they're just having too much fun whacking the mole. I mean, they're just getting too much political, you know, like you said, political hay out of this. And I don't think they want to give this up until November. I mean, we saw that with the Democrats all last year, feeling that they had the stage and could beat up on Democrats in the hopes of winning big in November. And now Republicans have found the issue du jour and are not going to really give it up. At least leadership isn't.
The Democrats have their own arguments to make, though, as we heard from Congressman Blumenauer. I mean, they're not entirely on the defensive.
No, but I don't think, I mean, like I said, I think we're seeing movement among centrist Democrats, especially the blue dog conservative Democrats from conservative states. But you're hearing some pretty firm entrenchment from the leadership of both bodies.
So back to Ben Geeman with the Greenwire News Service. Do you agree that a compromise is somewhat unlikely, given the fact that both sides have arguments they want to make?
Looks that way insofar as what we're seeing a fairly kind of vicious partisan battle going on back and forth right now, and that, you know, it doesn't necessarily look like there's a lot of signs pointing towards some big, broad energy compromise right at the end of the session. On the other hand, if the parties make the calculation that heading into this election cycle, it's better to make a deal and, you know, try and find some way to thread that needle and have both sides be able to claim victory, then I think that's possible. I mean, we are seeing some, as Robert points out, we're seeing some efforts to kind of float some bipartisan packages that would involve most likely a very, very modest expansion of offshore production and merge those with some conservation measures. You know, I think one thing that we're going to see is we've seen a bit of a tonal shift by the Democrats, who have been essentially forced to say, and look, you know, we support drilling too, it's just there's plenty of acreage available to the companies already. And so again, though, whether or not, you know, back to the question, there's support for any type of broad-based relaxation of the moratoria, that's looking pretty unlikely. But whether they could thread the needle and have some kind of deal, that's, I think, conceivable. But, you know, as the earlier conversation suggests and as Robert suggests, we're seeing a fairly pitched battle right now.
Ben Geeman with the Greenwire News Service and Environment and Energy Daily. Robert Dillon, back to you with the Energy Intelligence Group and Fairbanks Daily News. Minor, would you then agree that if there were going to be an agreement, it would be something fairly minor league?
I think so. I don't think you're going to see anything. But if you're, you know, with all legislation, I mean, if you got a compromise, it usually means it's pretty watered down. I think the Democrats are still going to stick to their guns, though, convinced that they're going to have the presidency next year and a much wider majority in both bodies. And I think they're determined. You know, you're seeing some serious work behind the scenes, though, in the Senate Energy Committee with Senator Bingaman and Senator Murkowski, who will be ranking next year, the Alaska senator, you know, to try to work on some compromise legislation. And I think this whole talk of energy has not really been focused on the Energy Committee yet, but I think that's where it's shifting next year, and I think you'll see a lot more bipartisan movement this year. I don't think either side really wants to hand a victory so close to the election.
It was interesting. We didn't hear Earl Blumenauer, our Democrat, big environmentalist, mention the environment until after it had been brought up by Mark Conaway are Republican. In California, this has been a major environmental issue since 1969 when there was an enormous oil spill. Hasn't been one like it, although there has been leakage from offshore oil drilling off of Santa Barbara. Recent polls show that with oil prices and gasoline prices going up, there is a shift in opinion, even in California, with just 51% now opposed to offshore oil drilling. Eric Smith is a political science professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He specializes in environmental politics. And, Professor, good to have you on our show.
Thank you for inviting me.
The president's offshore moratorium is gone. President Bush got rid of that. Now there's still a congressional moratorium, which we're talking about now. In the long term, even if there isn't some sort of agreement of the kind we're talking about of a major nature this session, do you think that it's dead?
In the long term, public opinion is probably going to follow oil prices. And in the long run, oil prices are going up, and so public support for offshore oil drilling will go up. So I think the bottom line is eventually there will be offshore oil drilling. And I think the question for the Democrats and the environmentalists is to try to figure out what they can get in exchange for allowing offshore oil drilling.
So public opinion then always will be the driver here?
Not the only driver, but certainly an important one. Public opinion tracks oil prices quite well, nationally and in California. When prices were high in 1979 and 80, majorities wanted more offshore oil drilling. When the price of oil bottomed out in 1998 and 99, public was overwhelmingly against it. It's going back up, and public support is also. And this is something that is not some obscure issue. People are paying every day for gasoline. They see the price. That's the connection. It's very immediate, a very direct impact. And that, I think, will force Congress to pay attention to public opinion.
Last week, we heard Al Gore make an impassioned plea for a real effort to get the economy off oil, at least as far as the power plants are concerned, and to do that very soon. What about the prospect of Democrats and environmentalists and even some Republicans seizing on this moment as an opportunity to start talking more about global warming and actually proposing to do something about it?
I think it's actually a great opportunity, but probably not until after the November elections. If you think about the debate that we've been hearing on your show and even nationally for the last few months, everybody's talking about oil. But this oil drilling isn't really going to have any impact for 7 to 15 years, maybe 20. So why not look at oil policy more broadly? For example, high on the list of a lot of environmentalists is changing the production tax credit. That is the tax credit that helps wind and solar power. Right now we've got a one-year extension. Why not think in broad, long-term view, and that is the same 7 to 15-year window. Why not extend the tax credit for 15 years? Once we're looking at the issues more broadly, I think we'll get a much better set of policies out.
Eric Smith, again, a political science professor at UC Santa Barbara. Robert Dillon, back to you with the Energy Intelligence Group. Is that the kind of thing, do you think, that the Democrats are looking for if they think, as you indicated, that are they going to take over the White House and have a greater majority in Congress?
Well, I think they're expecting to push through whatever, what they want next year. The problem is, and I agree with your last guest, is that, they're missing an opportunity to come up with a grand compromise here. There's a lot of these wind credits and all the things. The problem is, with all the renewable investment that they want to do, they run into problems with paying for it. And so why not take the opportunity to develop more oil for the short term? 30, 40 years is still the short term when we're looking at our energy infrastructure. And invest that money, invest heavily in renewables for the next, for the next energy reality. You're just not seeing that kind of vision on Capitol Hill. You're just talking about the short-term political gains of each side's position on partisan battle.
Now, Ben Geeman, back to you, Greenwire News Service. What about the vision that says that we might actually do serious damage to the environment if we drilled offshore?
Well, I think right now this debate is being driven largely by how to respond to these high energy prices that we're seeing. And so if you look at sort of what the Democrats and the Republicans are saying, yes, there is certainly an environmental component to the debate, but it's largely about this idea of what short and long-term steps could be taken to lower prices at the pump soon. Now, of course, there are very, very few short-term steps that can be taken. And so I think to the extent the debate over oil drilling specifically has been unfolding, it's been largely price-driven, and there's been sort of less of an emphasis on the environmental effect. And one other thing I would point out, just as sort of a side note, is that, of course, the debate over clean sources of power, such as wind and solar and oil drilling, are in some ways linked, but I think it's pretty important to keep in mind that right now in the United States, you know, wind and solar and nuclear and coal, these are things that keep the lights on, whereas oil is what we refine and put into our gas tanks. So for the time being, anyway, there's a fairly limited overlap as to how far you can go replacing oil with wind and solar power. Now, perhaps in the future, and one thing that I think a lot of people are very excited about, is this idea of plug-in hybrid cars, and then you sort of could see a merger of the electricity system and the transportation system. But right now, some of these things exist in somewhat different orbits.
Back to Eric Smith, our political science professor at UC Santa Barbara. Governor Schwarzenegger was mentioned a moment ago, a Republican who's very much against the idea of drilling offshore. Has even suggested that he might be an energy official in an Obama administration. It was a rather surprising comment from him. Some question as to whether he really realized how big the audience was that he was making it for. How complicated did the politics get with centrist Republicans like him on the same side as liberal Democrats?
Well, the politics, that partly what you're talking about is the politics of California, in which a whole bunch of Republicans, not quite all, but certainly most of them, are pretty gun-shy when it comes to offshore oil drilling. They've lost badly in the past. They want to stay away from it. So Schwarzenegger's move across the line to the pro-environment side is a big step, and it's, in fact, putting a lot of pressure on Republicans.
What's your own feeling? You said you think that the moratorium probably will fall. Are you yourself in favor of the moratorium?
I just don't see any long-term possibility that it's not going to fall. Peak oil is really going to have to happen to us sooner or later. Some environmentalists claim it's happening now. I think it's much more realistic to expect it to happen in the 2030s. But when it does, it's going to be politically impossible to save the moratorium. I just don't see any chance of that. So my point of view is that we ought to think long-term, think about alternatives to oil and to look at what we can get in exchange for weakening the offshore oil moratorium.
But in the short term, then, even if there is a risk to the environment, you think that's going to be a risk that people will be willing to take?
According to public opinion polls, that is certainly a risk they're willing to take. The public does care about the environment, but they care much more about day-to-day and economic issues. And the day-to-day economic issues put a lot of pressure on them, or give them a reason, I should say, to call for steps to do something about it. Now, realistically, nothing we can do in the short term is going to affect gasoline prices. And a lot of people simply don't understand that. That's why the public is so strongly in favor of increasing offshore oil drilling.
Robert Dillon, quickly, with the Energy Intelligence Group, do you think that the moratorium ultimately will go away?
I think so. I mean, remember, 6 months ago we were all worried about polar bears and Antarctic and Alaska, and now I think that debate came back up again. I think people's priorities shift with their pocketbook, and unfortunately, for better or for worse, environmental cares are what you can afford when gas is $2 a gallon, not when it's $4 or $5 a gallon.
Ben Geeman with the Green Wire News Service. Do you agree with that as well, that the environment may well be sacrificed if, in fact, there is a threat to it from offshore oil drilling?
You know, it's a provocative idea that the moratoria are basically toast and it's only a matter of time. I got to be honest, I disagree with it. Certainly if a President Obama is in and the Democrats continue to oppose this, I think as the years go by and different types of alternative fuels become perhaps more and more viable, I think then there could be an effort to, and a successful one, to sort of hold the line on this issue. I mean, of course, you know, oil and natural gas are going to be with us for a long time to come, but I would certainly not go so far as to predict that the moratorium are going to go away, and it's just watching the clock at this point. I disagree.
Those alternatives will have to come on pretty fast, won't they, given the kind of political pressure there is with high gasoline prices?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I think that when it's pointed out that we're never going to see a return to the days of you know, really cheap oil and gasoline. That may well be true, but at the same time, these things tend to fluctuate a great deal, even if you're in a sort of, you know, generally speaking, higher price environment. So, the question is, will we see this issue continue to dominate the public debate and the political debate in the way we're seeing it rage right now? Probably not. And so I think that right now we're seeing a sort of apex of the pressure on this issue, and unless prices go a lot higher, then I think that we'll see it calming down at some point. So, yeah, you know, who knows? Could the pressure eventually get to be to the point where they scrap them? Perhaps, but I certainly wouldn't put my money on it, and I think that's something that it's very difficult to predict right now.
Well, thank you to all of you for being with us. Ben Geeman with Greenwire News Service and the Environment and Energy Daily. Robert Dillon covering Alaska for Energy Intelligence Group, the Energy Intelligence Group, and a columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. And Eric Smith, political science professor, University of California, Santa Barbara. Good to have all of you on our program.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Barack Obama's overseas tour has gone from Afghanistan to Iraq, where he met today with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Over the weekend, Maliki seemed to endorse Obama's plan for pulling combat troops out of Iraq in his first 16 months in office. When the Bush administration asked for clarification, though, Maliki's office said that's not what he really meant. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The New York Times reports that an audio tape shows Prime Minister Maliki said this to Der Spiegel, the German magazine, quote, "Obama's remarks that if he takes office in 16 months, he would draw down the forces. We think that this period could increase or decrease a little, but that it could be suitable to end the presence of forces in Iraq." That, of course, was last week. There was much clarification over the weekend. Today, Obama and Maliki met in Baghdad, and Rich Uppel is covering the senator's tour for the New York Times. And, Rich, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks, Warren. It's good to be back.
Were there any further clarifications today from either the senator or from Prime Minister al-Maliki?
Well, actually, it seemed that the Prime Minister's spokesman, Ali Daba, actually went out of his way to emphasize to reporters that they would like to see withdrawal by 2010, you know, subject to what conditions on the ground are. But they seem to be, after furiously backpedaling at the urging, basically, of the American government yesterday, they seem to be back sort of singing talking about this sort of along the same lines that they did in the Der Spiegel interview of a few days ago.
Is Senator Obama saying anything about this? Is he claiming some sort of victory?
No, in fact, he's being very careful on this trip. He's not saying a lot. The only media kind of engagement I think he did all day today was when we caught up with him, when some reporters caught up with him after his meeting with Vice President Tariq al-Hashmi. And even then, he just simply talked about how he's pleased with the security improvements on the ground, that he obviously wants to, whatever our American policy is going forward, he wants it to be something that respects Iraqi sovereignty, that kind of things. You know, things that are very, you know, things we've heard from him for some time and that really were no surprise whatsoever.
Has the senator talked yet with the military leadership in Iraq?
Yes. I don't know the details of that, but my understanding, he's talked to several senior American officials since he's been here.
And would that include General Petraeus?
Yes, yes. In fact, I believe General Petraeus actually went out to the airport and picked him up this morning.
So they are having these contacts, but once again, judging from your experience, if you're lucky enough to run into him, they're not saying much about it.
Not much. He had a tight time schedule, but he was very careful with his comments today when he was meeting with Hashmi. To the extent that I know, that's, I think, the only time he's actually had actual contact with reporters all day, although that may change tonight or tomorrow morning.
Again, Rich Uppel is reporting for the New York Times. He is the Baghdad correspondent. Mark Benjamin is with us, too. He's national correspondent for Salon.com, but he's in Washington. Mark Benjamin, thank you for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
How difficult a situation is al-Maliki, Prime Minister al-Maliki, creating for the Bush administration, now coming back after saying he didn't really mean it when he brought up the name of Obama and said he'd like to see a 16-month withdrawal, give or take a little bit of time, now saying out by 2010?
Well, I think it's a problem for the Bush administration, but probably more importantly, it's poses a little bit of a problem for John McCain, who, of course, has been saying that timetables for withdrawal are a recipe for surrender. And so that's very similar to what the White House is saying. And now we've got, of course, the Prime Minister saying, yes, in fact, we do. That's what the Iraqi people want. Now, admittedly, Maliki is under significant pressure, domestic political pressure, to do just that.
So obviously the administration is hopeful that it can get the prime minister to do something. I don't think Senator McCain has direct relations with them. Does it appear that they're still working on this?
They are still working on it, and I think they've sort of gotten themselves into a little bit of a box here, the Bush administration, and for that matter, the McCain campaign as well, which is, you know, they've been arguing against a timeline for withdrawal. Having said that, things in terms of violence levels seem to be going in the good direction, to the extent that maybe it's time to start talking about a timeline. And in fact, that the White House this weekend started using some euphemisms, something like, you know, horizons and that kind of thing. So I think we're at the point where some sort of serious discussion about withdrawal is definitely coming down the pike.
The White House announced today that it's not going to reach agreement with the Maliki administration on some legal basis for keeping troops there after the end of this year. The UN mandate runs out. Does that seem to be related to this issue of deadlines?
It's related to deadlines, certainly, and then there are other issues, of course, in terms of, you know, liability for contractors that are working for the United States. And there are a host of issues on the table that the Iraqis and the American government are having difficulty sort of ironing out. But certainly, I think the biggest problem is how long are American troops going to be in Iraq and under what numbers? And, of course, this negotiation is complicated in no small part by the fact that elections are coming up in Iraq in the fall, and Maliki needs to position himself in a way that makes him, he believes, popular with his own people. He's a politician, too.
Mark Benjamin, national correspondent for Saladin.com in Washington. Back to Rich Oppel with the New York Times. In Baghdad, what about the political pressures on al-Maliki, and how are they related to this idea of a timetable for withdrawal?
Well, the country is going to have provincial elections. The officials here hope by the end of the year. You know, the Electoral Commission just came out yesterday and said that it might be impossible to have those elections until the very end of the year. They were originally scheduled for October 1st, but certainly what Maliki and other political leaders do not want to appear to be doing ahead of those elections is acquiescing to the occupiers. And you've got on his right, on one edge of the Shiite coalition or the Shiite political movement, you've got the Sadrists really, really urging him on a regular basis just to say no to the SOFA agreement, the Status of Forces agreement, and just tell the Americans to leave as soon as possible. And so he doesn't. I think a lot of the politicians here are very sensitive to the idea of not appearing to be too captive to the American occupiers ahead of those elections in a few months.
Are they at all sensitive to the fact that there's a political campaign going on in this country and that they have the power to have an impact on it?
I think there's some sensitivity to that, and certainly there's awareness, certainly among the more educated Iraqis, that there's a real difference between McCain's position on that and Obama's position on that. And it's interesting because, and this is certainly just talking about sort of the more, the sort of the professional class, the middle class, or what there is of that remains in Iraq. There's a sense that Obama, among a lot of them, that Obama is a is sort of the anti-Bush. I mean, he's a more humane guy. Who's a guy who will listen to them. He's someone who will, although he's never, of course, practiced Islam himself. You know, there's a sense among a lot of Iraqis that he does have a little bit of Muslim heritage through his father. And yet, on the other hand, there are also some of, you know, you talk to a lot of them, and they worry about the possibility that, you know, too abrupt a pullout could basically have a return to gang rule, as we saw a year ago, 2 years ago. So there's kind of that kind of conflicted sense about him that you find among a lot of better educated Iraqis.
Father, of course, a secular Muslim, so-called, so the connection to Islam is somewhat blunted apparently by that. Back to Mark Benjamin with Salon.com. Is the McCain campaign, or do you suspect this McCain campaign, is frustrated by the kind of attention that Obama is getting on this trip?
No, they're definitely frustrated. I think a lot of conservatives are frustrated because, you know, something along the lines of 200 reporters, I read, tried to get on this congressional delegation trip with Obama, and of course all the major networks sent anchors. You know, John McCain went to Central America recently. I'm not sure anybody traveled with him, or a very, very small handful of press. So yes, I think they're frustrated that Obama, not only does he have more money, but he's getting free press. I mean, he's not even saying anything, as Richard pointed out, on these trips. So yeah, I think they're very frustrated, and I think they're frustrated too that any advantage that McCain thought he had by, you know, arguing that the surge was working, and by all accounts there is a reduction of violence in Baghdad and the surrounding areas. A lot of that sort of gets chipped away at when Maliki comes out and says, "Hey, by the way, I think Obama's got a better plan here. Let's talk about a timeline for withdrawal." I think that makes the McCain camp frustrated as well.
Rich Oppel, a lot of security around Senator Obama as he moves around in Iraq?
Yes, quite a bit of security. No information released ahead of time about where he was going or anything like that. But yeah, very, very intense security.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Rich Oppel in Baghdad for the New York Times, Mark Benjamin in Washington, national correspondent for Salon.com. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Today's program produced by Dan Konecki with Karen Radziner and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.